Dr. Goddard flew his first experimental liquid fuel rocket in Massachusetts. In fact, I visited a farm in the vicinity of Auburn, Massachusetts, where he launched his, the world's first liquid fuel rocket. And as his experimentation went on, he had more and more problems with the local fire police. They felt one fine day one of these rockets may fall on the farmhouse and there may be trouble. And so he came to the conclusion that maybe he should go into a less densely populated area of the United States, also with more reliable weather than in Massachusetts. And so he went to Roswell, New Mexico, and spent several years there conducting flight experiments with larger rockets. Now, Roswell is about 100 miles or so from the White Sands Proving Grounds, also in New Mexico, where beginning 1946, the first V-2 flight were conducted to evaluate the V-2 in flight. And Goddard died about 1 year before this happened. He died in 1945, and the first V-2 flew in 46, only about 100 miles from where he had conducted his test.
Somewhere, I think it was Mrs. Goddard told me that you had a photograph of him in your room.
Yes, as I told you, I always considered Tchaikovsky, Goddard, and Obert the three great names in spaceflight, and they were my boyhood heroes, and I did have pictures of all three in my room at the boarding school where I was.
Gilbert Scott's brief material stream is an impossible advance on the new ideas only because of the military. I haven't seen a country yet where the pump was signed, really by military advisory things, whether there's nuclear energy, maybe even the White Brothers, the very first contract from the United States Army, I still have a copy of it. The theory that the Wright brothers were entitled or dependent on the speed of their airplane, and were some specifications in this contract that were that read outrageously funny. For instance, the military felt that this airplane would be of military use only if it could be folded together and transported on a horse-drawn army carriage. I haven't found a better answer yet to this, and all I can say is I was never motivated dropping bombs on everybody's head, just like the early aviation pioneers. I think we're not motivated by that. They just wanted to fly like the birds do, and I wanted to go to the moon, but it was a circuitous route.
But in reflecting on work together, military, war, and technological advances.
Well, I think very basically, man is, of course, interested in his security. And the fact that military budgets are voted year after year by the population probably indicates simply that people want to feel safe. They want to feel protected. They want to feel sheltered. And so they vote whatever it takes to get that protection for themselves and for their children. And, of course, the military game is a highly competitive one. You cannot afford to be second best. So military minds are continuously on the search of better ways of, building a fortress, or again, better ways of taking a fortress. And it has always been that way. Things have not really very greatly changed since the Middle Ages, or even since antiquity in this respect. Only the means have changed. And you can even go back in the history of architecture, for example, read the story of Michelangelo, how he virtually split his time between work in St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome and building fortresses for some Renaissance duke whenever there was trouble somewhere. I don't think we are very unique in this respect. I think it has always been this way, and we are just more aware of it today.
24th of May. Okay. Interview, 27th of May, 1971. You say your name,
Arthur Finamundi.
Hello,
you pass over?
I want to ask. I was deeply impressed and very impressed when I came to Peenemünde, almost blindfolded. First, for me, it was a new country. I didn't leave my country, Austria, before. I had some kind of communication problem. They were pretty fast. They disappeared pretty fast. And I was introduced to Dr. Riedel, the chief of the design organization. He asked me what my...
Riedel 3.
And also Mr. Dannenberg. And also Mr. Lindenberg. So when I heard about the oven, I just was really thinking in terms of a bigger steam plane, but finally I realized that I belong to the organization just designing the first flexible V2 engine. My first year and a half, I stayed on the drawing board and tried to do as much as I could and try to improve it. Houses for bachelor, for unmarried girls, and they were just, they fit, the houses really fit, and the scenery, and I'm a hillbilly, I come from the hilly area of Austria, and here was the big Baltic Sea, with a wonderful white sand beach, and the pine trees all around. I liked it, very, very much.
You ever heard of with rocket developments before?
No, I didn't hear anything, and that was the excitement. I heard about the nuclear physics and efforts, and I wasn't of the opinion they would send me there. I expected to go to Norwich, but I never heard about Peenemünde and never heard about rocketry at all. I was to a certain extent scared about the top security measures, and I had the feeling I'm maybe with one foot inside a tight and working area, and with one foot out. He lost two drawings and he lost his whole briefcase in a cage.
With a taxi cage.
With a confidential drawing. And they put him in a special army unit. They were all what do we call them? Degraded?
Decorated?
No.
Demoted.
They were all demoted, but they were still soldiers. Only they lost their rank and they had the simple strength, but they had to fight in areas where the worst.
That was still in a wartime.
Anyway, after the first design was finished, I started to help to get the fabrication on and also the testing. We started with water testing first and measured the flow rate for the combustibles. We had hydrostatic testing, dynamic testing, and then we started at the test stand to run the first test short time and then full time. It was also very impressive. I was not used to the noise, and it really impressed me deeply, this unknown noise, vibration, and so forth. And I remember we had always visitors in our test area where we tested the engine. I remember we had a CD downstairs in the basement, and we had high-ranking officer from the Navy, and there was a commander. He just dumped some creepy backwards when things started roaring and shaking, and there was a guy who caught him in the middle of the sea, otherwise he would have landed in the basement. Not to impress it, but just to show the first time a ghost or noise like this. And I remember I had a group of French visitors here. Some of the women, when they saw our first F1 engine, when they heard it, and so they broke out in tears. Okay, then we started assembling the engines and in the V1 first starters, and we had plenty of interface problems. Unfortunately,
V1, you were.
was a startup, and we had plenty of interface problems. Unfortunately,
V1. Did you work on the V1?
And V2, honestly.
No,
the first V2. We had quite many interface problems and interferences and mounting problems. But finally, we made it, and I remember very well when I witnessed the first captive firing of a V2. It was quite impressive, and I had the feeling we have it done, and the job needs just some slight modifications. But later on, when we had the first firings, I realized much more had to be done to solve all the problems. And I was out once to one of the first launchings. There were launch theaters from our working area. And one day, one of the V2 went straight up and turned around and flew to the airport. By the way, I was at the Aberdeen Proving Ground, the club. Okay, then we went on with our production. First, we had to find a place for our testing for our engine. So we found a on myself, we helped them to build up the Lehessen test end and installation. We were more or less consultants here for the mass production firing test installation. And also I was involved in the production test. We produced the V2 engine in Breslau and then in Linke Hofmann in Breslau. Linke Hofmann, that's a huge, huge factory. Linke, L-I-N-K-E, Hofmann. They have built 50% or 30% of the German railroad wagon open. Yeah. And then we also had to look for suppliers for components, and we found a few companies. They helped us either to manufacture the dome or the injector system or the bell for the engines. And also we found more companies that did the whole engine. Wonderful to see what people can do with, who have an education where they are more flexible with everything you ask them to do. Okay, then the working. You know, we didn't hear that, but the Russian had a tremendous, powerful radio system. And listening to their news was frightening. They talk two languages, a real soft and a real hard one, but we knew there's no pity. If they come, we have had it. And I was the last couple of months, I was deeply concerned about.
How much before the actual conquest of did you leave? How much before? Did you leave with the main group of the?
I was with the technical group, Dannenberg and Riedel and Paloro and so forth.
But this group by train or car?
By train and by car. We used train, and then Walter Sokovic, who lives up on Montesano, he had his own car, and we used the car too. And we went back, then we went down to Overamagal. And
the train, could you describe a little bit about the train? How did you get on in the train?
Was made up from different kinds of wagons which were existing. We were told that we cannot take more than one suitcase, and there were many people who didn't believe that they took more, and the honest guy believing that's all they can do, they took just one suitcase. Now, I was one of them, but shortly before we left, all of a sudden my parents-in-law, who had to flee from the Russian, appeared here helpless. So we got them on the plane. We went to Bavaria, the more people we talked. We were more or less isolated in Peenemünde, but people in the big cities, they saw the end coming more than we did. We saw many, many people running in different directions. They just didn't know what to do. And when we arrived in Oberammergau, the rumor spread around that the SS will take care of us. And I was deeply concerned about that.
Had you ever heard of that rumor before?
Never
before.
Was
there any impediment for you to leave Peenemünde? Some people have said that there was a possibility that all the German scientists and engineers would become part of the Volkssturm.
I think that does even happen, because in areas where communication and order wasn't well established anymore, there were people, active army units or SS units, which recruited people in the street and they had to stay. Now, we all had special papers, and if we wouldn't have had them, we couldn't have made it. So just with this special paper.
Do you remember what these papers were called?
I think they were signed off by the SS. If I'm not mistaken, they were signed off by Himmler or one...
Kamler.
That is true, yeah. It was him, yeah.
Did you know him first?
Yeah, he didn't live too far from where we lived in Banzin.
Did you have any comments about him, or was he like?
I didn't have. More contact I had with General Dornberg, talked open, but with him I didn't have too much contact.
Did you go to
Yeah. No, we had to stop in Lehet, no, in Salford, but we didn't stay long. The fellow went to Africa then.
Oh.
To Egypt.
So the exodus from Pinamoni was rather by groups. One group would be assigned and told to go. Do you remember what the last group was, go out?
The real last one? I think you should call Mr. Popel. I think he was one of the real last ones. We were real late too, but he was real late.
Okay, then you made the stop, short stop, and then continued down to Oberammergau?
We went down to Oberammergau, and...
Were there other Germans and Austrian on the other side, the Pinamundi people there?
There were regular SS there, and there was regular army there, and there were the huge portion of Finland, including Dr. von Braun.
Why was von Braun? The thing I don't quite understand, I'll ask you about this, but he was picked up in Austria, actually, a little town of Reutte. And I've often wondered why, when he made first contact with the Americans, why he was down there, Dornberger, that group, and Lyndon Meyer,
I think,
and Hutzel, and Magnus von Braun. Those are the guys that
I think we had an oxygen plant in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we always traveled between, Palloro knows the name of the plant, they always traveled between the two places, Bavaria, because the Oberammergau is not too far from the Austrian border.
Well, what did you do in Oberammergau when you first got there?
I tried to learn how to make cacao and fertilize. I just worked on a farm, and I was concerned that the cobalt was completely apart, and I was thinking about that. And then I talked to an officer there who could speak in French, and then he put me in an American prisoner of war camp. And then when I explained to an American what happened, they believed me, so they let me go. But then they called me again, another unit. Finally, I ended up under a blanket on a park, and I think I traveled about 150 kilometers without daring to look around. And that rock was thrown by a soldier who got a commission from an American officer to hit a German army truck. I don't know what he did for them. And he gave him permission to drive this thing home and hit. And he just, I was in the camp, and I heard the fellow talking to the American MP, and he showed them his certificate, A, that he's free, and secondly, that the car is his, the truck is his. And we had barbed wires around the place, but it wasn't too high. So I learned from the conversation that the fellow will take off 5 o'clock next morning, and I talked to him and say, may I jump on your truck? And he said, I have a big blanket there, canvas. He said, I don't mind. So around 3 o'clock, when the soldiers just walked by, you know, making their round, I just went under the barbed wires and on his rock and was laying under his canvas. And he went to the same place where my wife was, so I just had to hide under there. And each time he was stopped by MP, that chicken, you know, but it was raining, they were just too lazy to lift this heavy canvas.
So
see that I was a civilian. They didn't look at my paper this time. They said to Heinberg and Beichel, you take care of the 200 soldiers. And if one of them disappear, you also disappear. We finish you up. And we were afraid, how can you, without arms,
take care of
200 German soldiers who wanted to go home? But they didn't want to go home, just not to get in trouble. And next morning, all soldiers were there, we were there. but not a single American. They took off over the net and left us all back. We had... we just left too. And when we saw there's no American soldiers there anymore, we went home. And then when we were involved in the shooting in the woods, then a guy told us, it gives you, I think, 20 minutes. And you go to the next town, and if you don't make it in 20 minutes, we will be there in 20 minutes and then forget that you were alive. I remember she said some, forget that you were born or something like that. And I tell you, we rode this bicycle 30 miles an hour. Anyway, then we went to a small farmhouse and we wanted to stay overnight. And the fact that the SS was there in this area, we were just so concerned, people were so concerned, because they were told if they keep one SS man hidden in their house, this house will be burned down, you know.
Forget it was built.
Yeah. Yeah. So Hamburg and I and Bayer, I think, for a week. I don't know how many pieces of wood we cut. We just did nothing else, just cutting wood. And one day, all of a sudden, there came this first lieutenant. He hit Hamburg on, we were working the cellar, we didn't want to appear. He hit the guy on the shoulder, Hamburg, and said, you're good Russians, isn't it? And Hamburg said, no, we have no Russians, we are Germans. And then all of a sudden, he came up with his daughter, his mother, he's from Chicago, and his mother was a German. And he came and he had booze for us and food, and we were very happy. And one day I remember we had him against the wall, and then fellow came and he said, no, this fellow is also one from Peniminde. And I don't know if you heard the story, but the story is that Mr. Riedel got beaten up, being accused. You never heard this?
No,
I would like, they said they cut some teeth out of his mouth by beating on him, because we had this Lux containers, the small one, and people believed we had this kind of containers for nerve gases and poisonous gases. So the American soldiers believed that before they realized who he is. And I was told that they did quite some beating on him.
Let me ask you one question.
Yes, we were, as soldiers, we lived in private homes, and this was a resort area, and I remember they had Hitlerjugend during vacation time, but the owner, some of them, they stole the food, and the Hitlerjugend got enough to eat, but they gave them, instead of butter, they gave them margarine, and they kept the meat, and they gave them potatoes instead of... So some of these owners of this home, they had their cellar full with all kind of food, and I remember there was a group of Austrian, former Austrian Alpine soldiers, which just broke in one of the cellar, and there was sausage and ham, and they just cleaned the place up, and they distributed it. But I remember they went to Mr. Weidner. Weidner wouldn't have touched his life of sausage, don't bring it enough. He was always typical. Over. He would have died in front of a bowl of soup if he would have known that it was stolen. And that was my point. Yeah. And so we stayed there for a couple of months. And all the distance we just hiked. Then I built a little hand carriage there with four wheels we could disassemble. And then I had a soap box, American soap box, and I had a little kerosene burner, and a couple of pounds of grits, I remember. And then we just kept walking again toward Austria.
So your whole objective, you missed all the interrogation of the Peenemunde side. You
just took off and
you just took
go
off.
Home, yeah, go home to Austria. Mm-hmm. And then when I arrived in Austria, I got an invitation from Hans Paul Ore to come to Landshut.
Uh-huh.
Immediately. But it was so difficult to get a paper to cross the border, and I couldn't go to the English occupation administration, ask for a paper to rejoin the Peenemünde, because it was repeatedly announced in the radio that everybody who works in Peenemünde is supposed to go to the English occupation army's office. Otherwise, he's considered as a war criminal, and I just had enough of what I saw on the way home, so I just disappeared in a little corner and grass and said to report to the English occupation army in Austria.
And
if they wouldn't, if they didn't do it, they were considered as war criminals, but I still didn't go. No, I heard about just Peenemünde was repeatedly in the Austrian radio.
Were there many Peenemünde people in Austria?
No. I think there were, maybe because there was a group at the Axisen place, maybe they were looking for these guys more than far southeast where I came from.
And this is just like
in the dream. There was a broadcasting, English broadcasting, in German, saying that everybody who was in German is supposed to report the fourth.
Well, how long did you stay?
Janik, Pilz and Sang, they were together. Dr. Jaurnik. J-A-U-R-N-I-W-T, I think.
He was from Peenemünde.
He was from Peenemünde.
What was his specialty? Where
he was system analysis. He and Stoike and Pilz, they belonged together. They made test evaluation and also failure mode analysis.
Well,
you don't want to say hello, Mama?
Other Germans or Austrians or Peenemünde people ended up in France, and how did, like Pilz, I know Pilz.
Okay, Dr. Jaurnik was the head of the top man, and his share was more or less supported by Pilz and Zang. Zang, Z-A-N-G-L, Zang. And Zang later on made his PhD at the Sorbonne in Paris and died on a heart attack in an accident. Had a heart attack driving home. That happened already when I was already in America. I think I got the news that he died.
I'm sorry, I missed that because I was listening to
you.
Who died?
Zangl. Okay, yeah. And Pilz went to Egypt and then went back to Austria, and he's still in Austria.
Well, he was in, I saw him in Vernon. He was in Vernon for a long time after the war.
Yeah.
But that's before he went to Egypt.
That's what I said. He went to Egypt a year after I left, and I left in 50, I came 58. I left in 55, and he left France in 56.
And Pilz right now, what do you think he is?
He's in Austria.
I mean, do you know where?
I think in Tyrol, in Austria. Mm-hmm.
So we'd like to locate him. I wonder how we get his address.
I'm going home to Austria.
Could you find
him?
I'll give you a memorandum.
Give me a memorandum. Under Mr. Lang, he went back to Germany. Herbert Lang. Mm-hmm. And then there was a group building a proportion group, like Fuhrmann here, designing valves and containers and so forth. And this was under Joseph Schlotzer, S-C-H-L-O-T-Z-E-R. He's retired and he built a home in France. He stayed in France.
I wonder where he is.
I know where he is now. It's the godmother of one of his girls, and we have his address too.
So you could give us the address.
Yeah, that's right. Then there were only a few who got the French citizenship, and that's Mr. Habermann. He made the big run, and he's the big chef. Chief. A big chef. I'm mixing up German and English now. Chef and chef is a different. So he's the chief of Astriani in Vernon.
Where?
Vernon.
Oh, Vernon. He's still in Vernon.
He has a French citizenship. Yeah. Dr. Müller. Dr. Müller was the chief of Astriani, kind of Astriani organization in France. I think that's all
we had. So you had a nucleus of Germans, and then it was filled by French.
And then
and that was mainly at the aid of the Veronique Rock.
Veronique and then the Diamond. And I was still with engine and assembly. We made the vehicle assembly and engine development.
Now, what was Eugen Sanger?
Eugen Sanger was never with us. He was in Paris, close to Paris. And he was, there were two groups, more or less. One group was in Puteaux, and one group was in Vernon. And he belonged to the Puteaux group, and there was a German, few Germans with the Puteaux group. And one fellow with the Puteaux group was the fellow, the German fellow who died from test a couple of years ago.
From test, you can't hear me.
Pauli. He was also in France with the second rocket group in Paris, Puteaux. It's the It's an army place. It's a, PUT, we were kind of segregated.
What sort of introduced that by saying the first few months in France?
In the first year, I would say. The first year in France, we had quite some difficulties to find contact with the French civilians. We were, I would say, our job was respected. We were respected, but when we left the laboratory, we were more or less kind of isolated. The French people, they had even, they called them wardens, but they were more or less people, they observed us, and any move we made, going to downtown and coming home, was registered, and no French civilian dared to visit any of the Germans. And there were even some fights between the younger Germans. There was also Maybach Motorenwerke, the big Maybach company, which built this big engine for the German tanks, Panther and Tiger. They moved the whole, dismantled the whole company. I think they loaded all machines on, I think, 40 or 60 train wagon and moved them to our laboratory. And they were supposed to develop a 1,000 horsepower tank motor for the French army. And these young guys, they were mechanics and so forth. They got involved in fights and they were attacked. Later on, the thing calmed down, but still, one thing which really amazed me, I was in France for 9 years. We never were invited to any activities of the laboratory. The officers, we couldn't even not rent or lease a room at the officers' club for an evening. We all had our social activities. Activities in an old, rotten barrack. We only could go and eat at the officers' club. Completely. You know, I don't want to have the thing on tape, but one day Dr. von Braun had about three generals from France as guests here, and one general complimented my friend, and said, the first time I hear French, I can understand. He was just exaggerating. Then I told him where I learned it. And he wanted to know why I left